Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. A Missouri Supreme Court hearing scheduled about 90 minutes from now could have an impact on the proposed right to bear arms amendment on the Missouri ballot next month. We'll talk about it with our legal roundtable panelists on today's program. The St. Louis Archdiocese tosses in the towel on a pre-sex abuse case. Former Anheuser-Busch executive Francine Katz is not done with her discrimination suit against the brewery. And St. Louis City Hall weddings will test Missouri's same-sex marriage ban. I'm Don Marsh, lots to talk about with our legal panel today, including how the Supreme Court's Hobby Lobby decision affects our area. Joining me in studio, Mark Smith, Associate Vice Chancellor and Director of the Career Center at Washington University. Bill Freivogel is the Director of the School of Journalism at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. Joining us for the first time is Timothy Belts with the Clayton Law Firm of Otson, Leggett, and Belts. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us once again.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Seems like only yesterday we were together, and almost was, just 3 weeks of separation this time. I'd like to start with the St. Louis Archdiocese sex case that was settled recently. And the question that I have concerns settlements in general. This was a secret settlement. We don't know details. But I've heard a number of people say that if, in this case, the Archdiocese was so firm in rejecting the charges against it, why settle? Why do people settle?
Well, there are lots of reasons people settle even when they think the other side, when they think they are right and the other side is wrong. There are lots of incentives to settle a case. One, you know what's going to happen. Two, you don't have to pay the attorney's fees. You have costs associated. Three, the process goes away, and sometimes there are secondary effects of the process. You know, things come out in the public that you may not want. So, I mean, but as a business decision, settling is usually the right decision because you know what you're getting. It's something you can live with, and you don't have to pay the attorneys.
So basically you're saying it's a dollars and cents issue.
Sometimes. I mean, I suspect in this one, having a week of trial where you're not sure what's going to happen and what people might say, you know, could, I'm not saying it would, but could maybe hurt the reputation of of some of the people involved, and that doesn't, nobody likes that.
Mm-hmm. We were just talking last show about some of the embarrassing statements that the Archbishop made during a deposition. Well, the Archbishop would have been on the stand, as would possibly Cardinal, is it Cardinal Burke? Who was here, earlier? I don't think that was necessarily what they wanted to do. Why would they want to have these two high-level priests on the stand, having in some way to say that this woman is not telling the truth, which was basically what the archdiocese said. They said that the priest involved was an abuser, but hadn't done this abuse, that this woman had a problem which caused her to make up these kinds of allegations, this being an allegation that she had been raped by the priest, and that she had claimed her father was there and had witnessed part of it, and that the father had denied it. So they were very firm that this particular abuse hadn't happened, but that the priest involved was an abuser.
So I think if I hear what you're saying correctly, it's possible that they decided to spend whatever money they're going to spend to settle rather than embarrass members of the clergy.
Yeah.
Right. Which is really a collateral reason to avoid trial, what Bill mentions, because you may not be afraid of what's going to happen with your testimony at the trial, but how it will be used outside that trial. The other thing is, wasn't this in the city of St. Louis?
I believe so.
Yeah, I think so.
It was in circuit court in the city of St. Louis, in state court, which is a very dangerous place for defense lawyers to be traditionally. Not quite as dangerous as it used to be, but it still is. And so you can be 90% sure that you're going to win, but it's that other 10%. And what could happen if the one chance in 10 occurs that could really hurt you.
But let me just ask you to elaborate, Tim Belts, on your comment, it's a dangerous place to be. What precisely do you mean? Tough time winning cases?
Plaintiffs traditionally do pretty well in the city of St. Louis. The demographic makeup, the working class people, the unions, that people belong to. The plaintiffs get treated better traditionally in the city of St. Mm-hmm. Louis than they do in St. Louis County or St. Charles County, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Where in the city, you're more likely to have the jury made up of workers, where in the county, I think people would expect that there be, some managers and people who maybe see, who've made these kind of decisions in the past. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to teach a class for executives on the law. And, you know, what I always said about going to trial is because, you know, when you're a lawyer, you love it when your client says, this is outrageous. I'll take this to the highest court. You know, basically what you're hearing is this guy wants to spend a lot of money, you know. And I would always say that's not what and lawyers would tell that to their clients. But the thing is, going to trial, that's like the nuclear option. That's when everything else doesn't work. And settling is a reasonable thing for business people to do because, like I said, there's certainty and you get it done with. And, you know, if you go to trial, if your attorney is charging you, say, $300 an hour, and there's an associate there who's maybe going for $150 or something, you're talking about $500 an hour, basically. Trial, you know, for a week and preparation, you're talking a lot of money.
Experts,
right. And plus opportunity cost, all your people have to be down there. The costs are really high. So, and it's not at all unusual to have that settlement the morning of trial when everyone kind of comes in and push comes to shove and they have to make the decision.
Yeah, that was another point. It always seems to come right down to the wire before these settlements are announced. Let's segue from that story concerning the Archdiocese to Hobby Lobby. A lot has been said and a lot has been written already about the Hobby Lobby decision by the Supreme Court with regard to contraceptives and the Obamacare plan. Bill, you've written a lot about this. What is the impact of Hobby Lobby here? There are specific cases here that are affected.
Right. There were a number of similarly held private corporations that were nearly family held corporations that were similar to the Hobby Lobby situation, where the family running the corporation had religious objections to abortion. And Sharp Holdings was one of them. I think we'll talk about that in connection with Tim. And there were a number of others. Then there's also a whole set of cases and this sort of goes back to the Archdiocese involving an accommodation in the Obama contraceptive mandate for religious nonprofits, like Catholic Charities, for example. And the Archdiocese had filed a lawsuit saying that they felt as though the accommodation that had been offered by the Obama administration required it to violate its religious beliefs. And I think it was the day after or shortly after the Hobby Lobby decision was handed down at the end of June, the federal district court here issued a preliminary injunction saying to the Archdiocese that as long as their challenge to that accommodation was pending, that they didn't have to abide by it.
Well, Tim, you're involved in the Sharp Holdings case. Is that correct? Is that something you can talk about on the radio?
Sure.
Yeah. Well, please do.
Well, we brought the Sharp Holdings case a couple of years ago, right after all this excitement started when the news came out that this requirement was going to be made. And Sharp Holdings started out as a closely held for-profit corporation bringing a case just like Hobby Lobby, not as big, but just like Hobby Lobby. Mm-hmm. Sharp Holdings happens to be the place where a number of people are hired and where they work while they're in recovery in a ministry called CNS Ministries. But there wasn't any issue yet with CNS Ministries because that whole kind of case, known as the religious nonprofit type cases, were put on hold because the government hadn't figured out yet what sort of accommodation they were going to offer religious nonprofits. Mm. Now, churches got a free ride. They were exempted from the beginning by the government. But this class of religious nonprofits, which is neither a church nor a for-profit corporation like Hobby Lobby, is what we're dealing with right now in the wake, particularly, of Hobby Lobby being decided. And so religious nonprofits include hospitals, universities like St. Louis University, Catholic Charities, which was the party that was with the Archdiocese, and my client, CNS Ministries, which is a recovery center for men and women, but it's religious. And so the government has offered this accommodation, which says that, well, you don't have to buy the objectionable products, contraceptive products. In my case, like Hobby Lobby, it wasn't contraception so much as it was this four kinds out of the 20 contraceptives that can operate to destroy a fertilized egg. So we call those abortifacient contraceptives. And so those are what we object to. The problem arises in the religious nonprofit cases because the government offered a so-called solution, which was you don't have to buy the products, but what has to happen is you have to sign this form that authorizes your third-party administrator, if you're self-insured, to do it for you. Or in the case of if you have outside insurance, it authorizes your insurance company to do it for you. So you don't have to do it. They have to do it.
So you will move ahead with your case bolstered by the Hobby Lobby decision. Is that correct?
Yes, because our argument is really this. Hobby Lobby has just been decided. It says in no uncertain terms that nobody can be forced to provide contraceptive coverage to their employees if they have a religious objection. Our argument for the nonprofits is if you can't be required to provide it, then you can't be required to be complicit in the provision of it. In other words, if you don't have to provide it, then you shouldn't have to aid and abet its provision either. And so that's where the argument takes place.
Right. So that sort of goes to actually what was another sort of local, semi-local fallout. Right after Hobby Lobby was decided, the Supreme Court told Wheaton College from Illinois that they didn't need to sign this form 700, saying that they had religious objections to the provision of the contraceptives in question. They didn't have to sign that, although the government could require them to make clear that they had a religious objection. So this resulted in another really angry back and forth between the three female justices on the court. This time it was Sonia Sotomayor writing, and the rest of the court. And as mad as Justice Sotomayor was, it did seem as though the bottom line of that Wheaton College decision was, okay, not religious nonprofits, you don't have to sign this form, but you know, once it's clear to the government that you're not going to provide them, then the government can go ahead and make sure that the health administrator does provide them. So the court has seemed to be pretty clear, although they haven't actually decided it, that they're going to that this is not something that's going to keep the students and the employees of Wheaton College from getting the contraceptive care. It's just we're going to have to work out this question of do you have to sign the Form 700, or will there be some other way to communicate this to the government and for the government to communicate it to the health provider without trampling on the religious beliefs of the university.
You're really getting down into the weeds on these things, and we'll be hearing more about all of it.
Well, and maybe to take it out of the weeds, too, you know, two things. Do you have to take a break now, or can we?
I do, but
we'll take a break. We can come back.
All right, Mark. Okay. We'll take a break. That's Mark Smith from Washington University.
I need to take a break. Look on my face. Yeah.
Basically, we like to talk one at a time here, Mark. That's Mark Smith of Washington University. Bill Freivogel of SIU in Carbondale is also with us in studio, as is Timothy Belts, a local attorney with Ottson, Leggett & Belts, a Clayton law firm. We'll continue our legal roundtable panel discussion in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll continue our legal roundtable discussion in just a moment. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Missouri Governor Jay Nixon faces a deadline today to sign or veto 7 bills approved by the legislature. The bills include one that would allow specially trained teachers to carry concealed guns in the classroom. Another would task groups of parents and educators with crafting new school performance standards to replace the Common Core standards. St. Louis Mayor Francis Slay has named Alderman Jennifer Florida to replace the city's recorder of deeds, who had resigned on Friday amid a nepotism investigation. And 3 area congressmen hosted a summit today in Edwardsville to discuss the issue of human trafficking. Republicans John Shimkus, that is, Rodney Davis, and Ann Wagner invited several experts in the field to testify about the problem of people being traded for sexual slavery or forced labor. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our legal roundtable panel discussion with Mark Smith, Bill Freivogel, and Tim Belts. I'd like to pick up on the St. Louis same-sex marriage case. As many people know, 4 couples were married a couple of weeks ago in City Hall with the blessing of Mayor Slay and others. The question that comes to mind is, what now? It's in violation of a state constitutional ban on same-sex marriages. Where do we go from here? Thoughts?
Well, so the Attorney General says he's going to enforce the state ban, and so now we're going to have a lawsuit as to whether or not these marriages are legitimate or not. After last year's decision in the Defense of Marriage Act, where the Supreme Court threw out the Defense of Marriage Act for discriminating against same-sex couples that were married in states that permitted same-sex marriage. After that decision, there's been a whole run of federal court cases, mostly federal court cases, throwing out same-sex marriage bans all across the country. And there hasn't been a single decision on the other side. I've been pretty amazed that's happened. And, if it keeps happening, if this gets, by the time it gets back to the U.S. Supreme Court, which could be some of the issues could get there as soon as next fall. By the time it gets back to the U.S. Supreme Court, if all of the federal courts that have ruled on it have said same-sex marriage bans are unconstitutional because of what you said in your DOMA decision, it's going to be very hard for the Supreme Court to say otherwise.
Even this court?
Even this court. Momentum that would have been built up by those decisions.
I would have to think, and being the layperson here, obviously, that this would have to come up before the Supreme Court next term, simply because it is such an overriding issue in the country today and moving, as Bill said, so quickly. You think so, Tim?
I think Bill's right. I have an old rule that, and I'm old enough now to have old rules, the victim always wins. And if the law says, like it does in Missouri, that you can't have a same-sex marriage, and 2 people that really love each other want to have a same-sex marriage, the victim's going to win that case, I think, eventually. I think the playing field here is going to shift to where other victims are claiming their rights, like religious employers who don't want to hire a person engaged in a same-sex relationship or a same-sex marriage, et cetera. The same as in the Hobby Lobby case. Hobby Lobby was able to cast itself as the victim of federal regulation. Same-sex marriage proponents have cast themselves as the victims of laws that are seen by most judges as being unfair. Now the playing field is going to shift, I think, to the rights of people who don't want to go along with same-sex marriage. And I think that's going to be the next big battlefield.
So we have two, I think there are two lawsuits challenging, and it's a constitutional amendment. This is what we voted on in 2004 mm-hmm. and passed. Mm-hmm. Two lawsuits. It may take a while to get to the Supreme Court because they've got to go through the regular courts. And in case people are wondering, there won't be any more marriage license issued in St. Louis because Attorney General Koster, who is has said he favors same-sex partnerships, but has to follow the law, so he puts him in a kind of a difficult position, has filed a temporary restraining order, and an order was actually enjoining Sharon Carpenter, who was our recorder of deeds, not to her office agreed that they would give 2 days' business notice before they did anything more. So mm-hmm. we've got a stop to it, and I think we're going to wait, and they expect 12 to 18 months it'll take to get resolved.
But it doesn't have to be our case that no, would go before no. the Supreme Court.
No, it could be so many others. Kansas City case.
I think it's highly unlikely that the Missouri case will get to the U.S. Supreme Court before the court decides it with other cases. There's a Utah case that will get there. It looks like it may get there first. And the Supreme Court may do this in two steps. The Utah case that was going to get there first involves same-sex marriages that were performed in Utah, I think about 1,300 of them, during the period of time between when a lower court said your Utah's same-sex marriage ban is unconstitutional and the time that order was stayed. So there's 1,300 marriages out there that were performed, and that appears to be the first case that's going to get to the U.S. Supreme Court. So by the time Missouri gets around to it,
it may be done.
It's going to be done.
Would we be looking, do you think, from the court, and of course none of us knows, for a one-size-fits-all kind of decision? There are so many different states involved in this thing, all of which can be directed toward the Supreme Court. I wonder if that's what we would look for.
I think eventually it's going to have to get there. But like I say, I think it could go in various steps. What happens to these marriages that were performed, you know, in this hiatus between throwing out a ban and putting it on a stay? Another one would be, do you have to recognize same-sex marriages? Does Missouri have to recognize, for example, a same-sex marriage from Illinois?
Right.
So they could take it in a couple of steps. But, you know, at some point they may just say, hey, we're going to get there, so we're just going to get this done.
Right.
I'd like to spend a little time talking about the Francine Katz case, the former Anheuser-Busch executive, no longer obviously with the company, but who had filed suit and lost, claiming discrimination in a couple of areas, particularly with regard to compensation. She had indicated, her lawyer had indicated early on, I think, that she would not appeal the 9-3 verdict against her when the case was tried a couple of months ago, I guess now. But now she is going to appeal. What's the basis of this appeal? Do we have any knowledge of that?
Yeah. I think there are three grounds, but the strongest one seems to be related to the closing statement that was made by Anheuser-Busch's lawyer, Jim Bennett. And apparently he said in the closing, it's a discrimination case. The discrimination laws are about discrimination. Blah, blah, blah. And today, Katz's attorney has said, no, this was a case under the Human Rights Act, and that she's not required to prove that she was paid less compensation than male employees, only that her sex was a contributing factor. So there's a suggestion that this was that the law, the jury was kind of receiving a wrong summation of the law, and that is big enough. I mean, it's hard to know, and I haven't gone through all the briefs in detail, but it would seem to me that this is not likely to prevail. That would, if I were betting, that's what I would bet on. I think it's not uncommon to see post-trial motions like this, particularly when the defendant loses, but most of the times they don't go anywhere.
It doesn't seem to me, again, the layperson, as if these are very strong grounds for appeal.
Yeah. Or,
there's an old rule, speaking of old rules.
That's Tim again with the old rules.
That the first rule of appellate advocacy is to represent the appellee. That means, to translate that, the appellee is the one who won in the case below. Mm-hmm. And that there's never been a truer rule than that one. The chances of your winning an appeal like this one, where there was a jury verdict,
right,
and where the complaint doesn't appear to be as to a jury instruction, but as to what somebody said, I've seen better. I've seen cases that looked better on appeal. Mm.
And it was a 9-3 decision by the jury, which sounds like they were pretty well convinced during the trial.
Well, you know, an appeals court isn't going to rejudge, you know, second guess the jury. But if there was a misstatement of law, which is what they're claiming, then at least an appeals court could say, because this misstatement of law was made in an important part of the trial, then you have to do it over. Missouri's human relations bill law does not require equal pay for equal work, just that sex was a contributing factor in the way she was paid. So, I mean, I've read a couple of sex discrimination lawyers who thought it was that there was a chance that it could be reversed, but I think that Tim's right in saying that it's a long shot.
And just to be clear, this is a motion for a new trial, so it's still in front of the circuit court, but it would be the precursor to an appeal.
So the court could rule that there aren't sufficient grounds to continue with the appeal? Is that we are?
That there aren't sufficient grounds for a new trial, if they wanted to, they could appeal it. But right now we're still in front of the circuit court. This is a post-trial motion.
Okay. Enough on that. Let's move along to something else. This is almost in the realm of breaking news, because about an hour from now, the Missouri Supreme Court is going to be hearing arguments with regard to a ballot issue on the August ballot. That is the right to bear arms proposed constitutional amendment. The wording of that of the summary is what is being challenged. Can someone tell me exactly what the problem is here that they'll be talking about?
Well, the title of the amendment is, shall the Missouri Constitution be amended to include a declaration that the right to keep and bear arms is an unalienable right and that the state government is obligated to uphold that right? I think that it goes on to say that this unalienable right has to be receive what's called strict scrutiny, which means a great deal of constitutional protection in state courts. So what the police chief, St. Louis Police Chief C.M. Dotson, is arguing, along with others, is that the title is misleading, because there already is a right to bear arms in Missouri. So it's misleading the voter into thinking that there isn't currently, and that they have to pass this in order for there to be constitutional protection of the right to bear arms. Now, the other side says, hey, this whole thing is moot anyway. They've already sent out the ballots to the armed forces. They're voting already. It's too late.
Because this is for the August primary.
This is for the August primary. Yeah. But the fact that the Supreme Court agreed to take it and is arguing it so fast makes me wonder whether they might have a mind to do something about it.
One of the issues, as I understand it too, particularly with regard to the police chief, is the concern over the states, if this passes, the state's inability to draw legislation concerning concealed weapons, that the police are concerned about this. Is that – am I misunderstanding something, or am I on the right track?
Well, I was skimming through the amendment, and it seems to still permit some sort of regulation of guns. But it certainly – I think it does provide – even though there is currently constitutional protection for bearing arms, it does seem to me that it expands that amount of constitutional protection by saying it's going to be protected even more strongly in the Constitution. And it has added in words like, you know, not only to bear arms, but also to have as much – to have a certain amount of ammunition. Right. So I'm sure that's among the things that concerns
– And this strict scrutiny language that Bill pointed to, I mean, that's a – that's a buzzword among in the law that basically means it's probably not going to work. And you know, a law subject to strict scrutiny usually fails. Right. So that's what's got everyone worked up, I think.
Tim Belts, is there an old saying with regard to
strict scrutiny?
Yes, there is.
Well, let's have it.
Strict scrutiny, when a law is subjected to strict scrutiny, it gets overturned. That's the rule.
That's right.
It's conceivable that it wouldn't, but that never works out that way.
Right.
Very few exceptions. Affirmative action would be one of the few.
There is another constitutional amendment on the ballot, and I'll just bring it up here because, again, I'm a little bit confused about it. The right to farm proposed constitutional amendment. Mm-hmm. Do we not have a right to farm in the state of Missouri? What does that mean?
Well, I think we do have a right to farm, but you know, this all grows out of, remember that Proposition B a few years ago on puppy mills, and that really was, you know, it passed, but it passed with support from the urban areas and opposition from the rural areas. It was very divisive. It ended up getting changed and sort of compromised in the legislature. So it's an outgrowth of that. I think maybe there might be a political motive in that there at least was a feeling maybe that this would be a get out the vote kind of thing for Republicans. I noticed that it looks like some of the opponents are using the sort of foreign Chinese factory farm to try to. To try to oppose it, saying, okay, you know, this is going to allow the Chinese factory farm to do all sorts of terrible things in the rural communities. So it's I think it's a little bit unclear exactly what real farmers are going to think. I'm sure they're for the freedom of farm, but they're not all of them are happy with what the big factory farms do in their communities.
Just to read from my notes here, the constitutional amendment proposed to ensure the right of Missouri citizens to engage in agricultural production and ranching practices shall not be infringed. You know, sometimes you have to wonder about some of these constitutional amendments and, you know, the what they're there for.
Well, one of the criticisms of it has been that it really would do nothing. But I think, like Bill said, it's kind of – I see it as a reaction to that puppy mill legislation and the pushback that came out of that.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's take another break, and we'll continue our legal roundtable discussion in just a moment with Mark Smith, from whom you just heard. Bill Freivogel is also with us, as is Tim Belts with Otson Leggett and Belts at Clayton Law Firm. Back to continue the discussion, as I say, in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again. Welcome back to our legal roundtable panel discussion. We have been talking about proposed constitutional amendments on the ballot on August 5th. And Tim, you said something off the air that I find most interesting, and that is it seems to me that every time we have constitutional amendments on the ballot, there's all sorts of stuff going on with regard to the legal challenges and all the rest of it. You've been involved in some of that.
Yes, and it is a madhouse going toward the election because – you don't have much time. The way the statute is written governs these things, you can have everything happening within 2 or 3 months of the election. More typically, it's 6 months, but that's still a very, very short time to do all the discovery, to gather all the documents, to do all the expert testimony that has to be and prepare all of that, and then to go up and down all the way to the Supreme Court through the courts of appeals, and so on, and you as a litigator, you are just screaming that you want to have more time, but the problem is, unlike a regular trial, the election won't wait.
You know,
Mark, not the way the law is supposed to work. The law is supposed to take time and have people think about it and, you know, mull it over and not make like a snap judgment. And this kind of forces what sometimes can be bad decisions. We had another case just before, I don't know if it went to the Supreme Court, but about one of the candidates in one of the state rep seats in the city who the Secretary of State said was not qualified because she hadn't voted in the district long enough. She said, well, I didn't vote because it was a political action. I thought the system was kind of screwed up, so this was my protest. And our old friend David, what was David?
Who, Roland.
Roland. He represented her. So she got they overturned the Secretary of State's action and said she gets to remain on the ballot. I think her name is last name is Vowell. But once again, moving really quickly and not the way the law typically works.
Most of the time, it seems to me, and perhaps it's a false impression, when we're talking about proposed amendments or ballot initiatives, it's a question of wording. That seems to come up time and time and time
again. The wording and the summary of it, seems to come up a lot, the title and the summary.
It does. A lot of quite a number of Robin Carnahan's summaries were challenged. Most of them, I think, ended up being upheld, although not, I think not all of them. But, you know, if the I guess if I were reading tea leaves, the fact that the Missouri Supreme Court is taking this up today makes me think they want to do something with it. But if they and I'm talking about the gun initiative, but if they do, the state legislature is going to scream bloody murder and say that the you know, what is the court doing interfering with an election that's already being voted on?
I'm going to move back to the Supreme Court now with regard to a couple of other decisions that have come down since we last met. One is the abortion buffer zone ruling. The other concerned cell phones and the fact that police may not search cell phones without a warrant. Thoughts about that? Surprises anyone with those particular decisions?
The cell phone case was unanimous, and the court came down on the side of privacy pretty strongly. We've talked in the past how changing technology can often be a challenge for the courts, what to do with that. But they said, we're going to make police officers get a warrant before they can start poking around in your phone and seeing what all you have in there, unless there's, you know, it's an impending terrorist attack or there's a kid who's going to die or something like that. But even then, after the fact, you're going to have to justify it. So kind of interesting that it was so strong.
An awful lot of information on those,
phones. And on the cloud. And it included information on the cloud that you can access through your phone.
I thought one of the most telling comments in this thing was by some WAG who quite correctly, I think, pointed out that the reason it was unanimous is because all of the justices on the Supreme Court have cell phones.
I think that's true. This is definitely a trend on the court. In that, if you look back at that decision, I guess it was maybe a couple of years ago now, on global positioning technology being put by police onto a suspect's car to follow where they were going. You know, I think I remember the justices asked during that oral argument, you know, could you put this on our cars? And yeah, we could do that. Right. So this technology is definitely getting their attention, and I think causing them to see things and to protect privacy interests more than they have in recent decades.
As we've said many times in this program, there's a lot of law yet to be written with regard to today's technology.
Right.
But Tim, you mentioned that all of the justices have cell phones. They also have a buffer zone around the Supreme Court. However, they did rule basically on the abortion buffer zone thing. They struck down a Massachusetts law which would have required protesters to stay outside a 35-foot buffer zone. So a lot of people have said this is a hypocrisy on the part of the court. What do you think?
I never have heard that argument before. Whether it's hypocrisy or not, it wouldn't be the first time there was hypocrisy in Washington.
Right.
There's a lot of hypocrisy wherever politicians are gathered. Mm-hmm. But I think that the opinion, obviously, it was a 9-0.
It was a free speech decision.
Yeah, it was a free speech, and it was 9-0. But you know what? This was one of a couple of 9-0 rulings that were actually 5-4 if you look at how people voted.
Exactly, right.
So five of the justices, which was the Chief Justice joining the four liberals, said this buffer zone's too big, but that doesn't mean you can't write a buffer zone law. The other four justices in dissent, the more conservative ones, would have thrown out a previous Supreme Court precedent that had approved buffer zones. So actually, there was actually that 5-4 split. The same sort of thing happened actually on the recess appointments. There was a 9-0 vote that Obama had gone too far in the way he put NLRB folks onto the National Labor Relations Board. But there was a philosophical 5-4 split. You had Scalia saying, as he always does, you got to interpret the Constitution the way it was originally meant, And then you had five justices with Stephen Breyer writing saying, Well, you got to pay attention to historical developments. This is an evolving constitution. So Scalia was really very mad, even though he was in the unanimous ruling.
And on the abortion case, like Bill said, this split with the majority kind of saying, viewing this as more time and place restrictions. You know, that you can have free speech, but the government can put restrictions on the time and place as long as it's not specific to the content. And then the minority, more conservative justice is saying, well, when you really look at this, it's about content. This is really about anti-abortion speech, and that's what you're limiting, and they would have been much more restrictive. And I think that's one of the trends to take out away from this term. Even though you have these unanimous, and now I forgot the term, but it's kind of like the unhappy concurrence, where before you would have people reading their dissent saying this is wrong. Now you got people reading their concurrence, which says, I go along with the decision. I just think you got there the wrong way, and I'm pretty angry about the way you got there, and let me talk about that a little bit. And Scalia did a few of those.
Right. We need to remember on the buffer zone that this is a sidewalk they're talking about.
Right, public sidewalk.
It's
right.
A public sidewalk. It is one of the great traditional public speech forum. Fora, I should say. So we're not talking about property that's owned by a private company or by Planned Parenthood or whoever. It's a public sidewalk. And the argument that the free speech wing of the court used was that if you have this buffer zone, you are allowing speech within it that encourages use of the abortion clinic, but you are forbidding speech that discourages use of it. And so that
was the minority's position.
Was the minority's position. But they all agreed in the result.
Exactly.
Mark, you mentioned about looking at trends of the court. Let's spend a couple of minutes talking about this session just ended. And I'll start with you, Bill. What do you see? What stands out to you, not with regard to the decisions necessarily, but with regard to the tone and some of the trends that developed?
Well, I think that you could argue that free speech claims usually win. Corporations do quite well. Free speech claims that are connected to wealthy interests do well. For example, to try to back that up, earlier in the term, there was this aggregate spending limit that was thrown out on a free speech campaign spending limit. Saying that there shouldn't be this cap on what rich donors could give to a bunch of different candidates, and that violated the rich donors' free speech rights. It was sort of the progeny of Citizens United saying corporations could give unlimited campaign expenditures. Another example of free speech being used in a way that actually is seen as possibly backing or moneyed interests was the case involving the home health worker over in Illinois. Now, this was a not a rich person. It was a home health worker who said, I don't want to have to pay union dues. Mm-hmm. I want that money to be able to go to help my patient, who is my son. But what concerns some people who look at that case is that it sets up the possibility of saying the court saying in the future, well, there's a First Amendment right of public employees not to pay mandatory union dues, and if that were to happen, then we'd have a situation where government employees' unions would be harmed. Mm-hmm. Another big development, I think, is these privacy cases we were just talking about. Lee Epstein, who is a Washington U professor, has looked at the voting records of all the justices who have been on the court since the World War II, and she's written an article in which she finds that Justices Alito and Roberts are the two justices during that time period since World War II who have voted in favor of corporations more often than any other justices mm-hmm. who have served, and that five of the justices who are on the court now are amongst the top justices who vote for corporate interests.
Yeah. Tim, when you look back on the session, what do you see?
Well, when I hear Bill's pretty thorough coverage of the waterfront there, I hear that victims win.
to repeat the old adage.
Yeah. Right.
Yes. Yeah. And sometimes a corporation, sometimes a big corporation, can cast itself as a victim of government overreaching. But what's interesting to me is how conservatives today, like Hobby Lobby, et cetera, are reaching back and using arguments that were really put forward by liberal courts. Mm-hmm. Conservatives today are using the terminology and the theories that the Warren Court, known for its liberalism, espoused. And I don't think today's progressives really know what to do with that development.
How about you, Mark?
I was just going to say, you know, I don't think this Supreme Court term was a it wasn't a huge term. I don't think we're going to have any cases really that will make the Conlogue casebooks necessarily. It's not like when we had the Heller decision or some of the other stuff, the guns case or the speech case, the Citizens United. I do think, and there was a real interesting New York Times article about, you know, saying that Roberts is being very crafty about how he, because he wants to have unanimity, and he's doing it in ways by who he assigns to write the opinion, so we have less of these divided decisions, but we have these concurrences, and so there's a suggestion that he's playing the long game, that kind of setting things up for maybe some what could be big game-changer cases.
For his own personal legacy is what a lot of people
say. But also because he sincerely believes this is the way the law should be. And so he's, like I said, he's playing a long game. And and also, you know, with these unanimous cases, you got to remember, too, that a lot of these Supreme Court cases are kind of goofball. Not goofball, but they're boring. even by our standards, boring cases. Patent cases make up 10% of their docket. It's easy to get a unanimous decision, I think, on a patent case than on maybe something dealing with the Affordable Care Act.
Right. What about the role of the women justices, Bill?
Well, they certainly see issues like the contraceptive mandate differently than the male justices appointed by Republican presidents. I mean, you really can see if you read the opinions and listen to the statements that are made in court on the last days of the term, there's really a strong antipathy there on those kinds of issues.
I think there's
anger, sort of a feeling that these white male justices not all of them are white, that these male justices don't get it. I think it doesn't extend. I don't think it extends much beyond the cases involving issues that relate to women, although, the three mm-hmm. – the three women all were appointed by Democratic presidents, so they do have a different – they're likely to have a different view than the five who in the conservative majority who were appointed by Republican presidents.
To say, though, that – and I know this isn't what Bill's saying, but to say that five men can't form a majority on the contraceptive coverage issue is really a classic ad hominem argument. That is not a principled argument, and it's really not fair to say that because you're a man, you are less likely to be able to reach the right conclusion on a subject that includes that has to do with both men and women.
No, I would agree. I would agree with that. Now, another kind of argument that you've heard people make is, there was the Catholic justices who took this position. Mm-hmm. I think that's another kind of ad hominem argument that's not really very fair.
Just a few seconds left. A final thought from you, Mark, on that? Do you want to?
No, I think that's pretty good. I do think, though, this idea of the furious concurrence, that's going to be like that's the headline for this term, I think. And it's kind of interesting. It's a new thing.
Furious concurrence.
Furious concurrence. That was I didn't come up with that. Somebody else did, but I think it's really appropriate.
We'll have to make a note. We'll have to edit on that note well, the furious concurrence note. That was Mark Smith. You just heard from Associate Vice Chancellor at Washington University and Director of the Career Center there. He's been with us in studio today, as has Bill Freivogel, Director of the School of Journalism at SIU in Carbondale. Also with us is Timothy Belts with Otson Leggett & Belts at Clayton Law Firm. Tim, thank you so much for being with us. Come back and see us, will you?
Pleasure. Thank you.
Good to have you all with us. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about a program at the Missouri History Museum in which teenagers have written and performed a play about St. Louis's problems with gangs and gun violence. And we'll talk about how Missouri's only U.S. President, Harry Truman, got his political start. And for a show later this week, we'll be talking about summertime activities in St. Louis. We want to know your favorite activity. Email us at talk@stlpublicradio.org and tell us what it is and why it is. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.